military officials say Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive against the Russian invasion. Some are speculating that it may have already started. President Volodymyr Zelensky has not announced the launch of a formal campaign to push back Russia's front line, but reports say Ukrainian commanders are shifting to offensive actions and sending in some heavy machinery to eastern regions of the country. Still, Ukraine has not committed its main forces to the battle, as reported, raising questions about the country's current military strategy and its strengths. All of this comes as a major dam in southern Ukraine collapsed yesterday, and both sides of the conflict are blaming each other for its destruction and the people's lives who are now in peril because of it. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Let us know about your opinion on the current situation in Ukraine and Russia's involvement in it. Do you think it's time for Ukraine to launch its counteroffensive? And what role should the U.S. be playing, if any? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. And Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and let's start with the Kakhovka Dam in Kherson, and that the lives that are now, you've got people reportedly on roofs asking to be rescued, and finger pointing going both ways. From afar, from all the way back here in the United States, how are you to make sense, how can we best make sense of this ongoing human tragedy that's happening right now?
Well, I guess there's a couple of ways to approach it. One is the question of who did it, and then there's the question of what the effects are going to be. I think it's overwhelmingly likely that the Russians are the one who blew up the dam, both from a sort of technical perspective, and that it would have been much easier for them to do it because they were in control of the dam physically at the time, and also in terms of motivation to do it. We're seeing the first steps of this long-awaited offensive on the Ukrainian side, and it seems fairly likely that the Russians plan this demolition of the dam as a both response to that in terms of saying, well, we can inflict casualties on you if you keep on attacking us, and also to try to divert resources from the war effort towards this humanitarian relief effort that's going to have to follow in the result of the dam being blown up and the flooding that's happening downstream.
Yeah, so as we look at that, what's happening right now there, the other story that's popped up recently is the U.S. intelligence getting a heads up on the Nord Stream pipeline and a plan that the Ukrainians had to blow up this pipeline last year. But the President Volodymyr Zelensky has said today that Ukraine was not behind the series of underwater explosions that crippled the Nord Stream gas pipelines in September. How do we begin to make sense of something like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I've thought about that a little bit recently as well. It never made a lot of sense that the Russians would blow up their own pipeline. So I was actually somewhat skeptical that it was Russia behind it when that blew up. And I thought it was fairly difficult or unlikely that the Ukrainians did it simply for logistical reasons. But as you say, leaks that came out through this Discord leak that surfaced recently indicate that the Ukrainians at least had a plan to do it, which has a certain resemblance to the events as they actually unfolded. So that certainly raises your sort of estimate of the likelihood that it was Ukraine that did it. I always thought it might be someone more local to the scene who was also hostile to Russia, one of the Baltic states, for instance, that might have done it. But it's certainly possible that it was Ukrainian saboteurs who did that. I think that's a bit different from this case, though, in terms of the main downside or risk for the Ukrainians in attacking the Nord Stream would be if it was discovered and proved that they had done it, then that would have made the Europeans and particularly the Germans mad at them and jeopardized their support. Whereas in this case, in the case of the Kakhovka Dam, you're talking about hundreds of square miles of territory that's been inundated. Tens of thousands of people who have to evacuate their homes. Their homes are going to be have to be destroyed in the end. Lives will be lost. Croplands won't be irrigated. So the cost on the Ukrainian side is enormous. And it's not clear what the benefit would be in terms of advantaging the Ukrainian side So I think it's just extremely unlikely that the Ukrainians did it in this case.
The dam that was holding back the Dnipro River in Ukraine, Kherson there, also was involved in keeping a cooling pool, as I understand it, for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Is there reason to be concerned about the future of that power plant as you see it, Andrew?
Well, there's going to be reason to be concerned about that as long as it's in Russian hands. In terms of the immediate short-term future, there isn't. There's somewhat more reason, but not enormous reason, in the sense that they have a cooling pond that is still intact for the power plant itself, which they can draw upon to cool the plant for the foreseeable future in terms of, you know, months looking ahead. That there's no immediate risk of a meltdown or anything serious like that. And they've shut down much of the plant, so the need for cooling waters has been reduced considerably. So in the short term, we're not worried about that, you know, barring any further Russian activity to sabotage or blow up or disable the plant in some way. There is a possibility, of course, that as part of this summer offensive, that there's going to be fighting in that region. The region of the power plant. It's upstream of that dam that was just blown up, and it's on the path essentially from the Ukrainian-Russian front lines as they exist today to the Black Sea or the Azov Sea coast that the Ukrainians might be hoping to eventually reach in order to try to cut off Russian access to Crimea and all the forces to the west of that point. And so it might see further fighting in the future, or at least be, you know, in the vicinity of fighting.
Andy Kidd, our guest, political science professor at UW-Madison, taking a look at the Russian war in Ukraine 15 months in. And what are the international rules about things like blowing up dams or blowing up pipelines? And is it rules be damned when it comes to wars like these, Andy?
Well, rules be damned is sort of a good pun in this case. So in the past, you know, dams were blown up in wars. In World War II, the dam across further upstream on the Dnieper River was blown up by the Russians when the Germans were coming in. And then the Germans repaired it a little bit and then blew it up again on their way out in 1943. So, and of course, there was the famous raid by British bombers on German dams in the Ruhr Valley. So that's happened in the past. However, that's now been deemed to be, you know, contravention to the laws of war as they were codified in about 1949. So blowing up big civilian infrastructure projects like dams is now deemed to be against the laws of war. So that's been pointed out means that the people who did this may face a liability if Russia loses the war and if they are eventually turned in or become subject to international prosecution. The pipeline is an interesting case. That might be another. I'm not sure if that would qualify in the sense, because you're not targeting civilian lives directly. It's a pipeline at the bottom of the ocean. There's environmental consequences, of course, in terms of pollution. So whether that would qualify as a violation of the laws of war is something I'm not as certain about that as the case of the dams.
Andy, how are we to assess whether or not the counteroffensive from Ukraine has even begun against Russian forces? Russian Defense Ministry said a couple days ago it had already thwarted a major Ukrainian attack in the Donetsk region, killing 300 troops and destroying 16 tanks, but that has not been verified. How do we go about figuring out what's actually happening through this fog of war?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a transition from the defensive phase of the war, more or less static along most of the front, with some defensive operations around Bakhmut, which gradually fell to the Russians, culminating last month in May, to a phase where the Ukrainians are going to be on the offensive. And you're seeing that in various locations along the front. Interestingly, a lot of the sources that were very forthcoming with where the Russians are attacking are not quite as forthcoming when it comes to where the Ukrainians are attacking. Essentially because they're sort of heeding Ukrainian pleas for operational security and, you know, secrecy about where their forces are moving. But I think what we're seeing is sort of the overture, if you will, of the summer offensive, the spring or summer offensive, depending on how you want to think of it now. That is, the Ukrainians are attacking here and there, looking for weak points, trying to fake the Russians out. They don't want to just attack in a huge manner at one particular location that put all their eggs in that basket. They probably have very good intelligence about where Russian forces are, but they, you know, by attacking here and there, they can keep the Russians off balance and look for a point where the Russians may be weaker than they would be somewhere else. And try to draw Russian forces away from whatever their main axis of advance is going to be, or attempted axis of advance is going to be. And they face the issue that everybody sort of knows, that it would be extremely advantageous for the Ukrainians to, as I mentioned, strike south to the Sea of Azov and cut the Russian forces off. And so that overall strategic objective seems pretty clear. And there's only a sort of limited number of axes you can take to get there. So the Russians can pretty easily sort of anticipate that. But, you know, there's enough leeway there to try to fake the Russians out about exactly where you're going to go and what routes you're going to take. And so they're probably trying to play that game now and lure the Russians off balance and get them where they would not be in the way.
We're talking with UW-Madison political science professor Andy Kidd about a upcoming counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia's invasion, and you can join with your questions. Do you support a counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. How much should the U.S. be involved as you see it? And what questions do you have about where things stand in Ukraine right now and what we can expect going forward? Ask our expert. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Andy Kidd. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison who researches armed conflict as well as international relations, and he's with us to discuss the latest on Russia's war in Ukraine and a potential counteroffensive against the invasion. You can join us. What questions do you have about Ukraine's military strategy here, and how much involvement do you think the U.S. should have in supporting the fight back against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And Andy, how significant are the U.S. and NATO interests in the success or failure of the counteroffensive, and what is the investment of U.S. and NATO right now and going forward?
Oh, I think our interests are pretty significant in the success of Ukraine's effort to defend itself against Russian aggression here. I mean, this war that started last year in February of 2022 was just an outright invasion by Russia of their neighboring country, Ukraine, with an attempt to overthrow the government and reincorporate it into a broader Russian empire, which Putin, I think, has been missing ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Back in 1991. So I think the stakes are incredibly high. If he were to succeed in doing that, then who knows where he would turn next, right? The eastern border of NATO would be then under threat from a renewed aggressive Russian dictatorship that has had enormous success in the face of weakness. So I think standing up to Putin is very important, very much in the Western interests, both the Europeans and the United States. I mean, the question you need to ask yourself is, where do you want to fight Russia? In Ukraine, where do you want to stop them, essentially? Do you want to just let them become as strong as they were back in the Cold War, and so we're fighting them on the German border, or, you know, containing them on the German border? Or do you want to stop them here? So I think it's very much in our interest to stop them where they are. And how we've been helping them? Yes, absolutely. We've been giving them increasingly sophisticated weapons. Key weapons back in the early going were the anti-tank weapons that helped them blunt the Russian offensive. Then we've heard about the HIMARS, the long-range rocket systems that enable them to strike a little bit further behind enemy lines. And we've been helping them with training. We've been helping them with equipping their new armored units that are going to be used in this offensive. So have the British, so have the Germans. They've been using Leopard armored vehicles from Germany, the Challengers from the UK, and they're going to get some Abrams tanks from the United States. Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems, anti-missile systems. So we've been helping them in a myriad of ways. And they've been using that very successfully. And I think that's the key difference between this conflict and conflicts in recent memory that the United States was involved in Afghanistan, for instance, and Iraq. Whereas in this case, the Ukrainians are eager recipients, eager users and adept users of everything we give them and doing all the fighting themselves. Whereas in the previous cases, that was not the case. We would supply and train units and then they would melt away and, desert and collapse and whatnot. And we were dealing with governments and units that were corrupt or less interested in fighting than would have been good for the cause. So in this case, the Ukrainians are doing the fighting, they're doing the dying, and we're helping them defend their country against an outright Russian aggression. So I think it's well worthwhile.
We spoke with you, Andy, on this show about the Russian war in Ukraine almost exactly a year ago when the war was just about 3 months old. A year later, what surprises you about where we are today, and what does that portend for what we can expect next?
I was somewhat favorably surprised by the offensives on the Ukrainian side last fall that regained a fair amount of territory in the north near Kharkiv and in the south, culminating when they recaptured Kherson along the Dnieper River. I thought that boded pretty well in terms of the Ukrainians still weren't that well equipped with Western weapons overall, and yet they were driving the Russians back in important operations. So that was pretty favorably surprising. And I think what the big question is, what's going to happen this summer? An offensive is coming. How successful will it be? Will they really achieve some big strategic success and get to the Sea of Azov? Who knows what could happen? I think if the Ukrainians were able to make some significant gains and take back a bunch of territory and give good promise that they were, worthy recipients of aid and making good use of it, then I think that's all to the good. If they weren't, if the Russians actually turned the tables and started making gains of their own, that would be disappointing. I think it's unlikely, given the enormous investment the Russians made to try to take Bakhmut and the relatively small gains that they made as a result of that. So I think the initiative is all on the Ukrainian side at this point. And so we'll just have to see what happens in the next couple of months.
Andy Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison, who specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. What do you make of some of the attacks we've seen into the borders of Russia? Although they've been small and they've been few in number, does that surprise you at all?
It's a little bit surprising, but I wouldn't pay too much attention to it. I think it's mostly a kind of a sideshow and a diversion. These are sort of Russian dissidents of one form or another, in some cases far-right neo-Nazi types, who are kind of piggybacking and taking advantage of this conflict to try to work out some of their animosity towards Putin, who kicked them out of Russia earlier, and they sort of circled back and ended up in Ukraine because that was one way they could, get back at Russia or the Russian government, the Putin government. But I don't think they're militarily significant. I don't think they're going to have any serious effect on the tide of war in this case. It's mostly a political theater and kind of a sideshow.
Is there a way to resolve this conflict and find peace with Russia, with Vladimir Putin still in control of Russia?
Yeah, if he's defeated. I mean, I think it's conceivable, and the goal that ought to be pursued is to liberate Ukrainian territory and reestablish the Ukrainian borders as they were before 2014. If that goal is achieved, then I think the war comes to an end. Putin, even if Putin is in power, if he's not in power, that's great. If he is still in power, there won't be much he can do. He could still, attack across the border. He could try to launch air raids or whatnot. But I think at that point, the war will be basically over and the Ukrainians will have won. So what happens to Putin after that? Some people think he can't retain power after such a humiliating defeat. That might be the case, but I think it's of lesser importance to the Ukrainian side.
Andrew Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison. Still time for you at 1-800-642-1234. And with this situation, and all the world's eyes watching the potential for a counter, expectations of a counteroffensive. Andy, what are you watching for next?
Well, I mean, the big question is, where are they going to strike exactly, and how they're going to do it? Are they really going to go for the southern strategy? Are they going to push more northern and eastern in Donetsk? So where the attack is going to happen? And the big question is, can they get through these Russian lines, right? The Russians have been building fortified lines for 6 months to a year now, laying these concrete so-called dragon's teeth, digging anti-tank ditches, laying mines and whatnot. And the question is, are the Ukrainians going to be able to punch through those fortifications and restore mobility? And if they can, then it's kind of all up for the Russians. But if the Russians are able to capably defend those fortified positions, then it could be very slow going. The Ukrainians will have to pay a lot for the advances that they make.
Andy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Kidd is political professor, professor of political science, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he specializes in armed conflict, international relations, and political violence. With us today to discuss the latest out of the war in Ukraine and the stakes involved in a counteroffensive against Russia, we want to invite you to continue this conversation and ask your questions or give us your comments at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you know, what you think, and what we can expect next.